2%.
The 2%'s right over here.
Oh, hey, Jenna. I didn't know you shopped here.
Yeah. Anything to support local food. Know what I mean?
I definitely do. Though that's not the only thing you do in the name of Good Eats, obviously.
Well, true. I also host Eating Matters every Wednesday at 5 p.m., where we talk about food policy and how it impacts all of us. Be sure to tune in.
All right, I gotta get the plug in there. I get it.
Yep, I'm hashtag shameless.
You know what else you can do to support the local food community, right?
Well, yeah. Make a donation to Heritage Radio Network, the world's pioneer food radio station.
That's right. And I gotta call you out on the whole local thing.
What do you mean?
Well, The Farm Report, A Taste of the Past, Japan Eats. Those are shows that take you around the country and the world.
I'll give you that. So how can listeners give their support?
It's pretty easy. Just go to heritageradionetwork.org and click on the big red heart in the top right corner. It's pretty easy from there.
Thanks.
Today's program was brought to you by the Nutritional Therapy Association, real education for people who believe in real food. For more information, visit nutritionaltherapy.com.
This is Michael Harlan Turkel, host of The Food Scene. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
And welcome to Sharp and Hot. I am your host, Chef Emily Peterson, joining you live from Roberta's Pizza in Bushwick, Brooklyn. This is episode number 140. It is August. I can see my camping vacation on the calendar. When I was a kid, I loved to get milk that expired on my birthday. I felt like my birthday was right around the corner. That's how I feel about our camping trip. But before that, I have two more episodes of Sharp and Hot to bring you this season, and I'm super excited and pumped because I got to go to a conference this weekend at a place outside of Philadelphia called Chanticleer Garden. If you are anywhere in the Northeast and you have access to a car, I cannot recommend going to Chanticleer more highly. It is a 60-acre, it's either 40 or 60-acre garden that's open to the public that started off belonging to a family of great wealth who was in the pharmaceutical industry in the 1800s. And when the last of the living family members died, they left enough money to take care of the gardens for 250 years. And they employ this incredibly generous, warm, open group of artists to maintain the garden. And I'm working on a pitch for a magazine about creativity and what happens when money is no object, and how just money alone or just creativity alone isn't enough to make something beautiful and perfect. But when you have both of those things, money, pressure off the table, and a group of creative people who work incredibly well together, all of the wonderful stuff that could happen. So if you're in the area, I highly recommend that you're allowed to eat there so you can bring a picnic, which is really rare. I used to work at Brooklyn Botanic Garden. You are not allowed to bring a picnic. Chanticleer encourages you to come, bring a bottle of wine. The sun sets over this giant hill, and they're closed in the wintertime. So you can only go when everything is absolutely perfect and beautiful. But the reason I was there was for a conference for a group called the Garden Writers Association. And my husband is a gardener, and he was definitely going because he's been searching for a peer group of like-minded people to join. And like any field, if you don't actively seek that kind of stuff out, whatever work it is that you're doing can feel really isolating. So this came across his Facebook feed, I think. And you know, he was like, I don't know if I should go, like, because it's weird, you know, even as a grown up, you don't want to go to something by yourself. You're not going to know anybody. And I was like, you're going. Like, I've heard him talking about this for years, and he's been a fan of the garden for years. I was like, you're totally going. But then when I looked at the itinerary and the speakers, I was like, well, I'm into that. And I'm also into that. And I'm definitely into that. So I carefully asked if I was allowed to go too, because I didn't want to like step on his toes. And like, if he told me he wanted a podcast, I'd be like, hey, pal, that's my thing. I will not. Not really, really, but kind of really, you know, like I didn't want him to think that I was encroaching on his parade, but he was excited that we would share the ride. So we left our kiddo camping with his grandparents and we went down, and this group of people have reaffirmed everything that I have tried to bring to you guys, the listeners, with the guests that I have interviewed, that you just don't quit. Just keep doing what you love and just keep expecting that you're going to have to work so hard. But if you do those things, you will make it. And whatever make it looks like is kind of up to you. But, you know, for me, it's like stop expecting that there's a finish line, you know, that there's some plateau. If to use a rock climbing metaphor, if I just get to that one ledge, then I'll be there. I'll have gotten there. And that maybe that's I think in my head, that's a cookbook or that's a food show or that's television or that's YouTube or that's whatever. The reality is you claw your way all the way up to that ledge. And what you learn is that there's just more rock wall. And you have to fall in love with that idea. So being in a room with these creative artists for whom the gardeners at Chanticleer anyway, which the getting a job at Chanticleer is like getting a job at Per Se. Like you have to be the best of the best. But it attracted all of these other people who were communicators. And the best part was I was the only food writer in the room. So I was like a novelty to everybody else, even though there's a huge overlap between horticulture and food, because you're growing tomatoes, you're growing Swiss chard, whatever it is in an ornamental garden. You need all of that space and water and air and everything else to grow food as well. And it was great because I was like the unique one, whereas usually I go to a food writer conference and we're literally all food writers standing in the room. So my point is, find your peer group of people that you want to spend time with who inspire you, because you'll come back from that. Even if it's just a one day, I mean, this was a one day thing that cost $75 and I feel completely re-energized. So that's my piece at the top. It's also the Olympics that I've been thoroughly enjoying. I'm only kind of half watching it. My toddler, however, who has been taking swim lessons since he was a small child, every time the swim is on, he stops whatever it is he's doing, and then he goes and sits in front of the television screen, crisscross applesauce. And the other night, he turned around and he said, "Mommy, I want to do that." So there it is, documented on this day in 2016. When he's standing on the podium holding a medal, we can say, "Hey, remember when that four-year-old said that he wanted to do that?" So that was super cool. And then I listened to my favorite podcast this morning on the drive into Brooklyn, and they asked a question that producer David, I have a question for you that I want to share.
Yes.
Okay. So let's say Rio calls you today and they say...
Rio calls,
and you have to be in an event tomorrow. Given the body and training that you have, which is Adonis-like.
I have a body for radio.
Me too. What would be your event of choice?
It would actually be fencing, because I used to fence.
So when you were a kid, were you a kid as a fencer, or was this an adult hobby?
I started somewhat late. I started when I was 14. I think a lot of the really successful fencers start when they're like 10 or maybe even younger, just like developing basic skills. But yeah.
Did you think that there was a chance that you would get to go to the Olympics?
I don't know. No.
That's the confidence
I
like.
That's the short answer, I guess. Yeah.
We were watching the swimmers who were like the top of their game, breaking all these world records. And when they talk, you know, it's like any sports player getting interviewed after the fact. It's like, what do you think they're going to say? They say either I swam really fast, or I should have swam faster, or swam faster.
Or, you know, it was God. God did it.
Right, it was God. There's a lot of thanking the big guy upstairs. But I was thinking about it, and I think I would do shooting, because it seems like the least athletic thing you'd have to do.
Yet the most American.
And yet the most American, right? You said before we went on the air, isn't it patriotic that the first gold medal in shooting goes to an American?
That's maybe what? Trivializing it. It is actually kind of painfully ironic.
It's painfully ironic, and yet also it's niche, right? Like, be good at something, pick what you're good at, and stick to it.
I should big up America real quick, though, because a men's fencer, an American men's fencer, won the silver medal in men's foil, which hasn't happened since the 50s, I believe. And actually, a men's fencer hasn't won a medal of any kind since the 80s, and this particular event, not since the 50s.
An American since the 50s?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Wow, that's amazing.
So, pretty impressive. Yeah, usually the Europeans dominate.
And I heard a little bit of fallout from the Brexit vote, apparently, as England is trying to make jousting an Olympic sport.
Wow.
Like knights on horses. So
they're just really going backwards.
There's a silver lining. Okay, so back to our entrepreneurial conversation. I want to bring on, joining us via phone from Addison County in beautiful northern Vermont, my dear friend from back in the Astor Center days, Lindsay Burke, and her friend and business partner, Matthew Orchard, who have started a company that when I think about this, I think these guys have it figured out. It is called The Origins of Food, and they take people on responsible culinary immersion travel experiences. Welcome to Sharp and Hot, you guys.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
So tell me a little bit about your company, The Origins of Food.
So Origins of Food is a concept that came out of some past experiences that both Lindsay and I shared while traveling around in Latin America. We were leading backpacking trips at the time with an NGO, and we saw a real interest out of some of our participants when we started to show them certain things about our food, and we started teaching them a little bit about food systems. And there was a real spark there and a real interest, and we thought, hey, this is something that we could really turn, you know, into maybe a successful business. There's definitely passion out there, and we share that passion. And so we thought we need to share this with as many people as we possibly can, and it allows us to travel to different places around the world and to eat and share great food, which is a perfect combination. So, yeah, it's making us really happy.
I mean, when you say it like that, it's like, God, why doesn't everybody do that? That sounds amazing. So, Lindsay, why don't you give me a little bit of your background and your sort of childhood story? How did you come to be so enamored of food and food systems?
Sure. Well, growing up, both of my parents were really interested in travel and good food. So I grew up just always knowing that I knew more about the restaurants and the final product, but I didn't really know much about food production. So I grew up going to restaurants and traveling around the Caribbean. And then once I went to Europe, my dad would say, oh, you're going to Venice. You have to go to this best gelato shop here. Or, oh, you're in Salamanca. You have to go eat the pork here. Like, he just knew where to eat no matter where I went. And once I was out of college and working in the corporate world, it was kind of the beginning of the celebrity chef scene, and I still followed that passion of restaurants, which led me to eventually working and volunteering at Astor Center, where I met you. And my volunteering at Astor Center, where they were talking about different wine pairings and how wine pairs with different cuisines and really paying attention to the details of cooking the food, I started volunteering more there than I was doing anything else. So I said, well, why am I spending all my time volunteering? Let me go learn something more, and I want to work in food. So I left the corporate world after being in, like, advertising and marketing and PR for about 7 years, thinking I'd go work at a winery in Argentina for a few months during the harvest, and then I'd go back to New York and work for a wine company or import wine. I didn't know. I just thought this would be a good path for me. But once I nailed this amazing internship at a winery in Argentina. It was a tiny boutique winery in the foothills of the Andes, and I was riding my bike to the winery, and it was just an amazing job. I was documenting the harvest. And once I started doing that, I was like, well, how am I going to go back to New York? I kept backpacking. I met new friends along the way. And I ended up volunteering at an NGO in Peru where I met Matt. And the volunteering, again, it just sparked this passion for me, and I found my voice in leadership. And I really saw that when people are taking out of their comfort zones and when they're seeing different systems than what we know back home, it really engages people, and it inspires them to make change at home. So once we, after the volunteering in Peru, we were hired by a really awesome NGO out of Toronto to lead backpacking trips, and they were experiential education, a lot of service learning and volunteering, and through that, Matt and I started incorporating our own passion for food, and that's when we saw there was a huge interest from our participants, who were mostly college age at the time, to learn more about where our food comes from, because there is such a disconnect at home. You know, you go to the supermarket, everything's wrapped in plastic. You don't know who your farmer is. And you really don't know anything about where the food comes from. And so at the winery, you know, the winemaker that I worked for had such a passion for his product, and he would sit there over dinner and tell me, you know, this is my life's work, and there's so much, it's science and it's art and it's a beautiful process. But at home, we're buying bottles of Malbec from Argentina for $8 or $9, and that's just not fair to the winemaker and the entire process where those grapes come from. So I really wanted to honor that and respect that, and that's where the idea for Origins of Food came from.
I want to get back to that cost per bottle. I'm making a note so that I don't get distracted, which is one of the things that I do really well. But Matthew, could you give me a similar origin story of how you came to be in the same place at the same time? Because it does not sound like you were growing up in America.
No. So I grew up in a small country town in Australia. I think I probably had quite a different journey to what Lindsay has just described. But it is kind of funny because when I met Lindsay and we started to develop this idea of what Origins of Food might look like, I really didn't have any idea in my head that I would enter into the food world and be working in this kind of industry. But the more we talked about it and the more I thought about my background and my family and where I and how I grew up, it really makes a lot of sense. You know, we had a couple of fruit trees in our backyard that Mom used to love making jams out of. We went blackberry picking, and we would take full advantage of seasonal foods, like you know, heading down to the local field and finding mushrooms in the fall. And I think unintentionally, my family really they really pushed this strong sort of education and respect for food systems and what's happening around us, and subtly just kept reminding us, you know, about certain little things. Like we'd go and we'd visit a dairy farm, and Dad would show us how the cows were milked and how they were brought in and how the process all works, because he grew up on a farm himself. So I think I've been immersed in agriculture and in the food world since I can really remember, but it took meeting Lindsay and us having these experiences in Latin America for me to really realize that was something that I could transfer into something like Origins of Food.
So either one of you can answer this question, but as young entrepreneurs, I'm wondering if you can walk us through the nuts and bolts of what it took to get a business off the ground. Did you have a business plan? Did you, you know, I think the initial like spark of an idea you both articulated incredibly well. I'm asking you too many questions at one time. What were some of the bullet points that you went through to get a business made with such passion?
Yeah, I think once we had the idea, I think we were fortunate in that we were already leading a traveling lifestyle, so we weren't locked into a 9-to-5 job, we didn't have a rent that we had to pay, we were still volunteering at the time, so we just, once we realized what we wanted to do, we did put a business plan together. I did some research online, and I found the SCORE website, which offers free business plans and a lot of free help for entrepreneurs. And once I did my business plan, at this point, actually, Matt wasn't sure he wanted to come on board yet. He was a little bit hesitant to take the leap. So I started the business plan, and I sent it to my dad, who is an attorney, and he looked at it. And I knew I was doing the business plan for myself more than, like, I wasn't going to ask for money from a bank or anything like that, because we actually didn't really need any startup capital for this type of business. So for me, it was very low risk. I knew I was passionate enough about it that if it was something that I wanted to do, it would happen. So once the business plan was kind of fleshed out, we started putting together a logo and a website, and slowly Matt came on board, and he's like, oh, this sounds like, yeah, maybe I do want to do it. And once we got the website up, it looked terrible, and the first logo was terrible, but, you know, we had it up there, and we kind of felt like it was official, and we could start talking about it. And then we started getting friends involved and asking them to look at it. And then over about a year, we really fine-tuned the website and the logo and kind of the branding. And then over the course of that year, we were able to kind of hone in on the product that we were going to, what were the first trips that we wanted to put up, were people interested in it, what were the themes, who was it helping, because a large part of our trips are actually supporting the local farmers that we visit. So it's very much a social enterprise. It's not a nonprofit. It's not a for-profit. It's it's like a B corporation or social entrepreneurship. So it was those various stages of like just getting the idea into fruition and having that website for me was really the turning point, and then we could start promoting it.
I'm so excited to have you tell your story because I like, you know, I think it's helpful for people to hear like, yeah, we made a business plan and it took a year. It's not like we had this great idea and then suddenly we had, you know, 15 people who we were taking, you know, on a flight. So thank you for sharing that. And the B Corp, that's a new thing from the IRS, right? Etsy, I think, is also a B Corp and it means that there is a certain amount of social mission or social justice, right?
Right, exactly. So it depends on the state that you're living in and where you incorporate your business. There is an actual nonprofit entity called B Corporation, but then there is also a government label called B Corp. So it depends on the state where you're incorporated. And then the mission is that you're not a nonprofit reports to a board of directors. A for-profit usually reports to their stockholders. A B Corp can have other bottom missions. So it's people, it's the environment, and it's profit. So it's like the three, it's a triple bottom line. It's not just a monetarily bottom line. So you can say part of my profit is putting money back into the environment or helping human rights issues, food justice issues. It doesn't always have to be a monetary bottom line.
I love that idea. And I'm glad that people like you are doing it because I want to participate as someone who knows that the money is going to someplace useful, but I don't have the acumen to pull it off like you guys do. So we're going to take a quick break, but when we get back, we are going to talk exactly how people can get involved and get on one of your trips and start experiencing the origins of food.
And this one's called Whiskey and Wine by The Hollows. We'll be right back.
Today's program was brought to you by the Nutritional Therapy Association. The Nutritional Therapy Association, NTA, is a vocational nutrition school that develops, trains, and certifies nutritional therapy practitioners and nutritional therapy consultants to understand and reverse the tragic and unsuspected effects of the modern diet on their clients based on their bio-individual nutritional needs. There's no perfect diet for everyone. Their philosophy is that the myriad of health problems that plague modern society result from weakness in the body's physiological foundations as a result of poor nutrition, and that everyone deserves to be healthy. Throughout NTA seminars, students access a wide range of educational tools and techniques that help identify and correct nutritional imbalances from a holistic perspective, emphasizing the importance of properly prepared, nutrient-dense whole foods. Their organization was founded on the teachings of Weston A. Price and the science of Dr. Francis M. Pottinger. For more information, visit nutritionaltherapy.com.
Welcome back to Sharp and Hot. I am Emily Peterson coming to you live with Lindsay Burke and Matthew Orchard, founders of Origins of Food. So let's talk about the fun stuff, you guys. What kind of tours do you have coming up? I was looking at holidays in Guatemala. That sounds amazing.
Yeah, so we're really excited about this. This is our sort of in the near future. We have two programs that are available coming up this winter. So the first one is from December 23rd to January 1st, and we're calling it Winter Escape. And the idea of this program is to just give you a general sense of food systems and food practices and Guatemalan culture over the 10-day program. So We've tried to create an itinerary that gives a good balance in between sort of educational elements and then also, you know, a good amount of time spent relaxing and enjoying the country and really immersing ourselves in what is Guatemala. So we're incorporating some yoga classes. There'll be surfing, obviously a bunch of food tours. We're really going to highlight the coffee industry because that is such an important factor in Guatemala. A huge amount of people dedicate their careers to coffee farming in the country. They produce amazingly good tasting coffee. And it's a really interesting process that I think a lot of us aren't really kind of aware of. You know, sort of most of us drink at least one cup of coffee a day, but most people, when you ask them, can't really tell you what a coffee tree looks like. So, you know, they're the kind of things that we want to educate people about. You know, like, this is what the plant looks like. This is how it's harvested. This is the amount of hours that go into producing this. And also we want to talk about, you know, what that return is for the coffee farmer. You know, how are they treated within the coffee system internationally? You know, how much of the money that is spent on one cup of coffee actually goes to them, considering they're the ones that do the majority of the labor. So, we're really excited about this program. It's going to be in a perfect time in Guatemala. The weather is beautiful. They call Guatemala the land of eternal spring, so you can expect fantastic weather. And we're really going to sort of lap up the culture and the music and the climate and the good food, of course.
I'm drinking a cup of coffee right now on the air, and it's coffee's one of those things that I think I know how it's made, but you can't do it locally in the Northeast. You can't do it yourself. And so, will you get to go and harvest coffee beans and roast them and drink coffee like that you've made yourself?
Absolutely, yeah. It's actually the harvest time in Guatemala. So we'll be able to harvest the fruit off the trees, see the entire processing process. But the whole process takes about 2 weeks. So the farmers will lead us through it really quickly. And we'll get to see the different stages of beans in the process. And then they'll also roast it, and then they'll grind it, and then we'll taste it. And it's the freshest cup of coffee you'll ever taste, and it's absolutely amazing. And being up in the coffee fields, on the mountains, on the volcanoes, it's an incredible experience, and really it makes you really appreciate that cup of coffee you have every day. Matt and I still buy our coffee green from this cooperative of coffee farmers that we used to work for in Guatemala, and we roast our coffee about probably every 2 weeks, and, you know, we can feel like we're contributing to a really fair coffee practice.
They ship you the coffee beans green?
Yeah. It's called De La Gente. I'll give them a little plug. De La Gente Coffee. And they're a coffee cooperative. It's an NGO that supports a coffee cooperative. They handle the business side, and the cooperative is self-run, and it's amazing. The coffee is really high quality. And you know that, like, 90% of the money is going back to the farmers, as opposed to the traditional coffee system where the coffee farmers might get 10 cents on the pound. Or,
man. Yeah. And, okay, so walk me through what is included in the price for taking the trip. What do people get?
Sure. So it's an all-inclusive trip. We provide 3 meals a day, snacks, drinking water, all of the in-country transportation. Matt and I will be your guides. We speak Spanish, so you don't have to worry about not speaking the language. We cover all of the cost of activities, whether it's the yoga, the surfing. What's not included is if you want to buy alcoholic beverages, which is definitely, you know, something that we do like to do every once in a while experience of culture. You know, you want to go out and see all parts of the culture. So it's just the alcohol and then any souvenirs that you want to bring home, which there will be plenty of coffee and textiles. Guatemala is beautiful. And we also cover the accommodation. What's not covered is flights from the U.S. or wherever you're traveling from to Guatemala City. But if you book it enough in advance, you can get really good deals out of the U.S. to Guatemala because it's actually quite close. It's only about a 4 or 5 hour flight.
And you have a deadline of November 7th, right? So if people are thinking that this might be something that they want to do, you cap the participants at 10. So you can go to theoriginsoffood.com to find out more about this. I just love what you guys are doing. I wish you the best of luck. You are incredibly articulate, and you are doing a wonderful service to the farmers that you are supporting.
Thank you so much, Emily.
Thanks, Emily.
All right. And I got to see if I can get enough scratch together because I want to learn how to surf in Guatemala because that's on my bucket list. So. Okay, so it's theoriginsoffood.com. Those guys are all over social media. You can find out more about them on their website. I am Emily Peterson. I am at Chef Emily P on Instagram and Twitter. I have gotten a bunch of emails from people, so I'm going to do some cooking questions next week. So if you have any of those that have been kicking around in your head and you want to ask them of me, now would be a good time. You can ask me on social media. I'm Emily Peterson on Facebook, or you can email me, chefemily@sharpandhot.com. I want to say thank you to David for engineering the show. Thank you to Peter Shukoff for the theme song. Sharp and Hot is produced by Heritage Radio Network, a nonprofit member-supported radio station devoted to all things food. Help keep HRN alive by becoming a member today. Go to heritageradionetwork.org, click the beating heart to donate. And while you're there, select Sharp and Hot from the little drop-down, and then I'll know that you're sending me the love directly. So I love that. Thank you to everyone who has left a review on iTunes. I really, truly appreciate that you spend half an hour a week with me. If you like what you hear, go over to iTunes and leave us a review on the podcast page. I will be back next week. We're going to have some live music, some cooking questions, and then we'll take a break for the rest of the summer. I hope you are all planning wonderful travel excursions yourselves. Until next week, everybody, thanks so much for listening, and keep playing with fire and knives.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.